Good afternoon, and welcome to Energy National Security Program at CSIS. For those who I haven't met, I'm Guy Caruso, senior advisor in the energy program, and we're really pleased that such a large turnout has come out this afternoon to hear an outstanding group of presenters and to engage in hopefully be a lively discussion on global gas markets. Freudian slip. CSIS has had a number of gas meetings, gas-related meetings, beginning with work we did with the World Resources Institute on the roadmap to a low-carbon energy economy, and gas played an important role in that work that was done in conjunction with WRI. And this is, I think, the eighth separate meeting now we've had on natural gas and its relation to energy and environment policy, not only in the U.S., but the global economy as well. This topic today is going to focus on global gas markets, and it's critically important not only for U.S. energy and environment policy, and definitely has important implications for debates that are going on the Hill now with climate change and broader energy policy issues, but also in the EU and in Asia, as those markets now are looking at a very different global gas market than I think many of us thought even 5 or 6 years ago when while I was at EIA, we talked about developing an EIA global gas model, and we're very fortunate to have three excellent presenters today. Glenn Sweetnam, who heads the division within EIA, projecting long-term gas markets in the U.S. and in international markets, I should say. And we'll present for the first time results of the work that's been done on the global model with the contractor ICF. And at this, indeed, EIA had a meeting at the ICF offices this morning, discuss some of the technical details. And I have to make one housekeeping announcement. It was one participant, and I hope that person's in the room here, who left their coat at that meeting. And so it's now at the ICF office. What's the
1725I.
So if you're that person who forgot his coat, and it's at the ICF offices. Secondly, about a year, not quite a year ago, I was speaking at a European gas meeting and on a panel with head of European gas markets for Wood Mackenzie, and he discussed the WoodMac global gas model, and I said it would be perfect if we could get someone from your organization together with EIA to discuss the two models and the results. And we're very lucky to have Jen Snyder, who heads up that part of WoodMac's practice here in the U.S., and the global gas model has been developed under her leadership. So she'll present some of the results of the WoodMac model. That's the kind of the format. Will Glenn and Jen will present model some of the insights that come out of the initial or the runs, most recent runs of those two models. And then we'll switch to a more topical format in the second part of the meeting, in which Jim Jensen, who is probably the dean of the global gas analyst in the United States for sure, will also be part of that discussion. And we're going to break that into three topics: impact of shale and Arctic gas on global supplies. Basically, this look, what's the supply curve look like? for gas, including, of course, LNG. And then second topic will be the very, I think, difficult to solve equation in both of the models, and that is how will gas be priced? And we have had this debate now, certainly going back at least 10 years or so, about regional pricing versus will there be a global gas price. So that'll be topic number two. And then finally, who are some of the key players in the global gas market? And, of course, Jim Jensen will make some lead that off. But the second part is designed to be very interactive, so we're going to keep the remarks short, but hopefully get comments and questions from all of you. Many of you I know are experts in global gas and domestic gas issues. So without in order to keep things moving, I want to ask Glenn Sweetnam to take a few minutes to present some of the initial results of the EIA global gas model. Glenn, thank you very much for coming. Oh, in terms of bios, I didn't get into a lot of detail, but the more detailed bios are in your handout, so thanks.
Okay, well, thank you, and I'm very happy to be here today. So I came to EIA October 2005, so just 4 years ago, and as Guy mentioned, he was very interested in modeling international gas markets, natural gas markets, and the reason was clear in that we kept projecting increased imports of LNG into the United States. The United States domestic gas supply was declining, and there was a recognition there was going to be a need for more imported gas, and the Canadians wouldn't be able to supply all that we'd want. So we needed to really understand how to integrate into the international gas market, how to integrate the U.S. models and the U.S. results and our outlook. And so every time Guy gave the new International Energy Outlook, which is the annual publication my division produces, he would say, can I talk about the international natural gas model? I'd say, not yet, Guy. The next year, well, can I talk about it now? Finally, the last time, he said, I guess I'm not going to be able to talk about it because I'm leaving and it's not ready. So I was really happy and relieved to be able to come to Guy and say, Guy, I'm ready to talk about it now. And he was gracious enough to allow us to talk about it here. And so that does bring up one point, which is that I'll show you one slide from the International Energy Outlook, last year, International Energy Outlook, three slides from the last year's annual energy outlook. And then the rest of what I'm going to show you is from our international natural gas model. And we're just in the process of tuning it up and correcting it as preparation for the next International Energy Outlook, which will be released next May. So these results are not final, but I think they're provocative enough, or I hope they're provocative enough, that we can have some good discussions about them. As Guy mentioned, we had a meeting with a number of gas experts this morning, and one of the things that's clear about the natural gas market is there are enormous uncertainties right now in a number of areas, and we hope to highlight those and sort of show that to you. So in terms of, gosh, this is not what I would have expected. Okay. For some reason, I've gotten out of order here. But let me just go back in the order I think it should be in. Sorry about that. It must have been late when I put this together. This is a chart from the International Energy Outlook. And this is the balance of what role does gas play in the world market. And you can see in 2006, gas provided about 23% of the world's primary energy. And what we expect to have happen is that it will stay at that share. So as the world economy recovers and as energy growth starts to, demand starts to grow again, gas will continue to play that role. And it looks pretty unexciting, pretty pedestrian, and just continue at that level. But actually, there's enormous variability in where that could end up. And let me show you why. In end uses, gas is going to be competing against non-stationary sources. So as much as gas would like to compete against oil because of the high price of oil. It really, in reality, in most situations, it's competing against other stationary sources of energy. So it's competing against coal. It's competing against electricity. It's competing against nuclear-generated electricity. Those sources are sort of lower value. So if it decides to compete at that level, if it decides to lower its price to be competitive, the upside potential is enormous for gas. On the other hand, if it restricts itself just to higher value markets, or if producers decide to hold back or only sell markets to markets that want to pay oil equivalent prices, then the demand won't be as rapid. So here we have a case where it's sort of continuing in the power sector, competing with coal in a number of regions, but also continuing to get oil equivalent in other regions. So this, once again, doesn't look very exciting. No great growth in it. No big shifting between the different uses of gas. But there are, in fact, enormous changes that are happening in the gas market. And one of them has to do with the production of shale gas. So in 1980, George Mitchell went to the Barnett Shale up around Dallas-Fort Worth in Tarrant County and knew there was gas in the rock, and he tried to figure out how do we get the gas out. He had an independent oil company. And it's often referred to as the 17-year overnight sensation. He figured out how to get gas out of the shale, and he found so much gas and brought so much gas out of the shale that he shifted the flow of gas, which normally went from Houston up to Dallas for the power plants in Dallas. Literally, they reversed the pipelines, taking from Dallas back down to Houston. And you produce so much gas. Well, this now has affected the whole U.S., not just the Barnett Shale, but that same technology for the shales in the United States. And as you can see, production was pretty steady there from 1997, in fact, a slight decline through 2005. But since 2005, gas production in the U.S. has been growing at 3.3% a year. And so that outlook that we had just 4 years ago that there was going to be this big increase in LNG imports has been turned on its head. And each year we reduce how much gas we think will be imported in terms of LNG. So what I've shown here is the annual energy outlook for 2006, 2007. Both those years we looked at over 4.5 TCF of gas being imported as LNG into the United States. Our last forecast, we get to 1.5 TCF and it declines after that. That has repercussions for the whole global trade of gas. So one key issue is will unconventional gas play a large role elsewhere in the world? It started here in the U.S., but other countries do have large resources of shale gas and tight gas. And one of the results out of our model is where does that gas get developed? And what I've shown here is this is 2035. The percentage of total gas consumption that'll be unconventional. It'll be shale gas, tight gas, or coal bed methane. And you can see in China, for example, we believe that their resource is so attractive and that they will find it so attractive to go after it that 62% of their gas production by 2035 will be the shale gas, the unconventional gas. In Australia, over 50% will be the coal bed methane. In the United States, we'll have about 43% of our gas will be the unconventional gas. So those are the big players. Yes, David?
And is that share of production or share of consumption?
Share of production, share of production. So it includes the exported volumes for Australia. So that large role. Now, they also have shale gas in Europe. And in the meeting this morning, we had a real disagreement, a different point of view of will Europe allow the development of the shale gas there? Will the ability to have indigenous gas to that region rather than importing gas from Russia and from the Middle East and Western Africa via LNG and from Northern Africa actually develop the gas in Western Europe, sort of be committed to that? Or will sort of the NIMBY issues, environmental issues, water issues, and the fact that mineral rights aren't privately owned in much of Western Europe, will that inhibit the development? In our model outlook, we have it coming fairly slowly, but that is an artificial constraint, not based on the geologic resource there. So that's one of the issues is the shale gas issue and how it gets developed and how it transforms the market. The next, then, is gets to trade. And in terms of the exporting and importing regions, what I've shown here is the net imports in 2006 and 2035 for each region. So these are regional imports. And so you can see the largest growth is Europe as a whole will import more gas as a region, an additional 15 billion cubic feet a day of gas, a 40% increase in their imports as a result of declining conventional production in Western Europe and not a corresponding increase in the unconventional. So their reliance on imports will increase. Japan, a slight increase. The United States import dependence declines. And then you can see on the far right, not importing a lot right now, but China and India both increasing imports. Where's the gas going to come from? For our model results, the three big exporters are Australia, the Middle East, and Russia. And probably not a lot of issue with Australia. Clearly, they have the gas in the Middle East, but the big question is Russia. How will Russia choose to respond to the potential for increased shale gas in Western Europe, and how will they secure the capital that's needed for them to meet the commitments there to provide that increased gas production? And so that also gets into the issue of Qatar in the Middle East, and Iran in the Middle East, and Russia, all are countries with large market power in the international natural gas market. And so how they choose to exercise that power will be important consideration. So then finally, that growth in exports means that we'll be growing both pipeline capacity, will be increasing over time, and this is just the incremental growth in pipeline capacity. Big increase in other Asia, and this is pipelines going from the Caspian region east to China recently. But then also you can see the Alaskan gas pipeline. We have it coming on here in 2017. That's probably a little bit optimistic by some lights, but that's sort of an open issue, too, to discuss. And, of course, the increase in liquefaction capacity. And what we've seen here just recently, and this was anticipation of the growing demand in the U.S. and elsewhere, was a large increase in liquefaction capacity over the last year or two, continuing out to about 2013, so that by 2013, we're talking about 42 billion cubic feet a day of export capacity. That compares to total U.S. consumption of about 60 BCF a day, so a large amount of gas. And it is that gas coming on, that gas capacity coming on, that's going to have a big effect on prices in the near term. And so let me just talk briefly about prices. As Guy had mentioned, we're going to talk about that. The model results here show a decline in prices in the near term. I don't want you to spend too much time looking at those peaks and valleys right there at the beginning. That's sort of just some constraints in the model as it gets settled down. But essentially, prices declining between now and 2014, and that's this new LNG capacity coming on before the demand has really grown to meet that supply. But then over time, as the demand catches up and then as producers have to go to more expensive resources, we see gas prices increasing over time. And a divergence occurs in the world market where the three consuming regions we have here, the consuming nodes of China South, Europe North, and Japan sort of go to higher prices, and then Qatar and Russia West stay relatively lower, and then the West South Central also stays low. So what our model with the assumptions we have in it right now is showing the U.S. disconnecting as a consuming country from the other consuming countries and literally relying on North America only and only seasonal LNG imports coming in. So on an average basis, prices being lower here in the United States than they are in Europe and Japan. The other issue of interest is just the large disconnect between the price of oil and the price of natural gas. You can see here on a heating value, the price of oil is about $22 per million BTU, so oil twice as high. And so does that story make sense that we can have this sustained difference between oil prices and gas prices over this long period? So with that, then, I'll wrap up and turn it over to Jim.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen, for coming.
First of all, I'd like to thank CSIS for the opportunity to speak today. And as well, I'd like to say that definitely all the uncertainty that we're dealing with, both in the North American market and as well the global markets, certainly makes speaking much more interesting. And we at Wood Mackenzie, as with the folks at EIA, are currently kind of putting the final touches on an update of our global gas modeling effort. And so we'll be releasing within the next couple of months some new results. But I'd like to talk through some of the results that we saw earlier this year in terms of our global gas model and also all the different changes that we're seeing roil through global gas markets with the change in economic expectations and as well with the change in U.S. shale production and expectations. And certainly what I'll present today is first, relative to Glenn's presentation, focused a little bit more on the near term and all the changes we see over the next 5 years through about 2020, and also some of the different producer strategies that we see heavily influencing prices as the global economy recovers from this downturn. And in particular, we feature a much less orderly progression of pricing dynamics across different regions through 2020, given the producer strategies that we're watching and trying to model. And certainly, again, that expectation for global recovery from the deep recession frames the outlook that we're showing you. And in fact, given the change in our expectations for global economic growth and U.S. economic growth and a view toward a very measured and slow recovery out of this financially driven downturn, it's really changed our expectations. That's an understatement. It's completely shifted our expectations for global gas demand. And in fact, we're seeing about a four-year delay in terms of global gas demand actually reaching expectations that we set forth before the recession deepened, the U.S. credit crisis deepened into a severe global recession. So again, it's completely reshifted our demand view globally, both primarily on the gas demand coming from the power sectors across the world, and as well for gas demand for industry, and really across the board, a shift down in terms of gas demand expectations and a destruction of about 20 BCF per day of gas demand as we look long term. And it's a permanent shift down simply because of the timing and the fact that we never move back up toward trend with that global economic growth. And certainly that demand retrenchment occurred just as we saw a wave of global liquefaction capacity actually hitting the market. So we've shifted demand down significantly with a four-year delay to meeting our previous expectations in terms of world demand, just as we're adding over the next few years about 11 BCF per day of new global liquefaction capacity. So a complete mismatch between this new demand trend and the amount of additional supply we're bringing into the market, certainly led by the Qatari megatrains coming into the world, LNG view over the next few years and ramping up. So, again, complete mismatch and a real disconnect between these new supplies and the reduced demand expectations after the recession. And I'll start with the Atlantic Basin and some of the impact of the changes on Atlantic Basin pricing dynamics. Certainly through 2008, the Pacific Basin, as basically LNG buyers were starved for supply, willing to pay up to oil parity and in some cases above oil parity to attract flexible LNG cargoes, we saw these Pacific Basin buyers bid into the Atlantic Basin and draw supplies from the Atlantic Basin into Pacific Basin markets. And that trend peaked in 2008 as Pacific buyers basically called on almost 2 BCF per day of Atlantic Basin demand. This year, with an increase in global LNG supplies in the Pacific Basin, and with that Asian demand retrenchment, we're seeing that pull from the Pacific Basin buyers on Atlantic Basin LNG supplies decline and collapse down below 400 million cubic feet per day. So the Atlantic Basin looks significantly weaker, not just because of the supply and demand changes within the region, but also because of what's happening within the Pacific Basin and the collapse in that appetite from Pacific Basin buyers. And as well within the Atlantic Basin, we're seeing this revolution in North American gas shale production. Glenn talked about the complete change over the last 2 years in U.S. supply, given the successful unlocking of shale development, given the cost improvements between December 2007 and January 2009, we grew by about about 8 BCF per day in terms of North American production, and we'll continue to grow rapidly that shale gas supply within North America. And to put some numbers around it, we're looking at growth of about 8 BCF per day in terms of North American shale gas supply between 2009 and 2015, even in a reduced pricing environment. Again, a complete change relative to expectations 5 years ago. And those shales effectively negate the need for North America to pull on LNG supplies to meet demand, in particular, given that reduced GDP expectation, just as those numbers are picking up. So another loosening in Atlantic Basin LNG markets. So the question going forward is what actually rationalizes this complete disconnect between supply and demand in the Atlantic Basin, both coming from the market side and as well from the new liquefaction capacity available, both from the freeing up of Pacific Basin, both based on the reduction in Pacific Basin pull on LNG and also new capacity within the region. And essentially what we're seeing over the next few years is that even though European markets are essentially supplied by take-or-pay contract levels, we're likely to see major European suppliers reduce essentially their market share within European end-use markets, kind of pull back a bit in terms of their production to cede some market share to LNG over the next few years in order to keep prices from collapsing. And essentially, we're looking at decline in Russian market share as these new LNG supplies come into the European markets, some decline in Algerian pipe supplies into Europe, in order to maintain price levels within Europe and to guard against a complete price collapse. And we are seeing some of that behavior, but essentially what it means is that utilization of European pipe supplies will hold down over the next few years as we work through this period of excess supply. And certainly, U.S. drilling will be restrained by the LNG that we actually see coming into the markets. Because even though we don't need LNG, the LNG market needs North America, and supplies will increase into this market as the new liquefaction capacity comes online. And essentially, what we see happening within Atlantic Basin prices is for 2009, 2010, 2011, and into 2012, very close relationships between prices in Europe and prices in the U.S. And again, the U.S. becomes a relatively competitive market for LNG deliveries. By 2012, 2013, as the economy really begins to recover, as European demand again begins to pick up, as the pace of capacity additions of liquefaction capacity slows, we see European prices move back up toward oil index contract terms within those markets. And so essentially what we see is between 2011 and 2013, a significant increase in European prices. North American prices hold back because of the unconventional resource base that we've developed, and we get an early gap between European prices and prices at the Henry Hub, given that resource base here.
What's your assumption for dollars?
Okay, our assumption is looking at a relatively similar exchange rate over the next few years compared with what we're seeing now. But essentially, a wide gap opens up between European prices, which trend back toward oil index terms, and U.S. Henry Hub prices. And what that means is that between 2011 and 2013, as those Atlantic Basin prices improve, we see a significant ramp up over the next few years in LNG supplies coming into North America, followed by a decline in LNG supplies 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015 as European markets recover and LNG suppliers seek markets with a higher netback. So as that price gap opens up, we see more supplies or more LNG cargoes delivered into those European markets. The other producer strategy that we do see taking hold, though, through this 2015-2016 timeframe is a potentially higher than expected flow of supplies into North America from Qatar. And our view is that even though higher netbacks might be available into European markets, into Asian markets, Qatar will continue to deliver baseload supplies into the U.S. in order to protect spot prices globally, and in particular to maintain European spot gas prices close to oil index terms, to maintain some of the oil index terms that they've historically held with buyers. And within the Pacific, I mentioned the fact that by 2009-2010, the Pacific Basin looks significantly looser in terms of its match between LNG demand and supply. That surplus essentially holds for 2011 and into 2012. But by 2013, as Asian demand recovers, and again, as the pace of liquefaction development slows, we see Pacific Basin buyers again needing to bid into the Atlantic Basin to attract supplies. By 2014-2015, Australian LNG begins to come into the market, and that gap closes again. So we go from a period of oversupply essentially within the Pacific Basin, or balance over the next few years, to a period of, again, tightness 2013-2014, to a looser market balance again by 2014-2015. And switch forward to what this means in terms of global gas prices. Essentially, the interesting dynamics take place in terms of our expectations on Japanese prices over the next few years. Again, given the oversupply, given the North American unconventional resource base, we see prices kind of bunched up together, okay, influenced heavily by the Henry Hub. 2012-2013, with some European pipe supplier restraint, with recovery in demand and a slowing in liquefaction capacity additions, we see European prices ramping up. With the tightness in the Pacific Basin and the need for Pacific Basin buyers to bid into the Atlantic Basin to attract supplies again, there's actually a quicker ramp in terms of Japanese prices. By 2017, however, as Australian LNG begins to come online, that Pacific Basin premium really erodes. And specifically what's happening in that 2016-17-18 timeframe with Australian LNG is that Qatar is losing a position of market power within the Pacific Basin, and we see that premium eroding. Longer term, we're looking at global gas prices increasing relative to prices at the Henry Hub, again, given that resource base that we see developing, or given that unconventional resource potential within the U.S., that gap does begin to widen out, similar to the picture that Glenn showed. So, again, two specific strategies by suppliers influence the progression of prices as we work out of this period of oversupply. One, Qatar's scale and scope and its ability to influence Pacific Basin prices, and the kind of ramp up and ramp down that creates in Japanese prices, and as well, the European pipe suppliers' incentives to hold gas prices hold spot gas prices close to the oil indexed price that they've seen in order to maintain their position in terms of contract negotiations. So again, an interesting dynamic, and one of the things that we've tried to capture in terms of the modeling are these specific producer incentives. And again, you know, still reflecting the oversupply and the tightening of the markets going forward, but it creates interesting cross-regional dynamics going forward. One of the things we're seeing now within the model, within our updated modeling, is that there's a real potential beyond 2017, not just for that Pacific Basin premium to collapse, but also to get some real downward pressure on oil indexation terms. Okay, so not necessarily a break in terms of long-term contracts from the oil-indexed agreements, but potentially a softening in the connection to oil prices. And one other thing I should note, and I actually should have noted before I started talking about this price, is I know that no one came today to talk about the Belarus price, but in fact, what that – maybe you did, I don't know. But what we're showing in that Belarus price is essentially a price that's representative of oil index contract terms in Europe. Okay, so you can see the disconnect below oil index contract terms and then the reconnection going forward. 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. Oh, got it. Okay. Belarus is in the orange, and it features the relatively flat Sorry about that. On my computer, they look different. Let me just go through the process.
Sure. This is the EU border. The Belarus is the border of the European Union.
Border of European Union, so they're always taking Russian oil index contract gas. Okay, so this is representative of the contract prices indexed to oil. And Belarus is here. Japan takes the down dip of relatively close global relationships for 2009-2010. As the economy recovers, European pipe suppliers show some constraint. That creates a real quick uptick as we work through the position of oversupply toward that oil index contract marker in the Belarus price. Japan has to bid into the Atlantic Basin for supplies, and given Qatar's market power within the Pacific Basin, it creates an even bigger hump in that Japanese price. Australian supplies come online and weaken Qatar's producer power within the Pacific Basin, and we see that Japanese price come back to a relationship with Europe. Long term, you know, we're seeing that kind of connection between spot prices and oil index terms maintained. But within the update we're looking at now, with the potential for unconventional development in Europe, we really do see some downward pressure on those market prices for the UK, which is here in blue, and Japan as well, relative to an oil index type contract.
What's the lowest? What's that low one?
The low one is the Henry Hub, thank you. And it reflects the view of marginal cost of supply within the U.S. market. So it's a tier one, tier two shale gas type price. And essentially, 550 to 650, 2012 through 2020.
Well, thank you very much, Jen. Well, now we'll move into the topical discussions, and the first one is going to be the impact of shale and Arctic gas on global supplies. I'll ask all three of our experts to give their views in a very concise manner, then open up for comments and questions from the floor. Glenn, would you lead off on the shale supply?
Happy to do it. Is this working? Or do I go? Yeah. Good. Thank you. Our outlook for the shale gas is that shale is likely to transform the global gas market the way it's transformed U.S. gas markets, that the increased gas production in the U.S., as I mentioned, is going to ripple throughout the global market and mean that we do not have a dependence or will not have to pay high prices to attract LNG, that will be a dump market, if you will, for LNG when it doesn't have another place to go. But we are very close to self-sufficiency in gas. And we see that happening also then in China and Australia, is that the unconventional gas really changes the game. And it changes the games for the players who have the enormous resources of conventional gas, Russia and Qatar. And so the ability of China to produce more indigenous gas will allow it to negotiate harder with suppliers in the Pacific Basin. And then the Australian gas, those resources will also add to the market supply. We're not as optimistic. I'm not as optimistic about Western Europe, because even though they have the resource there, they don't have the service industry or the industry structure that seems to lend itself to rapid development of that resource. And it's not a slam dunk. There's different perspectives on that, but I think the development there is going to be slower for the reasons we mentioned. And one of the things we can watch in the U.S. where we're developing the Marcellus shale up in Pennsylvania and see how much slower that process is compared to the developments on the Gulf Coast. And Jen, you might talk about that. I think Western Europe may be more like that, where the development comes much slower.
Jen?
Sure. I gave our view on shale gas production increases within North America through 2015, adding about 8 BCF per day of supply, but a very small percentage of that is from the Marcellus. And the reason is not geology, because based on the initial producer programs, test well programs within the Marcellus. The geology looks fantastic. The decline rates are lower than we've seen in other shales. And some of the producers are coming out with numbers that you know, we can back up between 250 and 350 for break-even costs in the Marcellus. So it's not the geology that's holding up the development. The progression is simply the cost of adding infrastructure, adding gathering infrastructure within the Northeast, dealing with regulatory uncertainty that hasn't been the case with the Haynesville. So things look really good, but it's going to take some time. And our view is, you know, as Glenn mentioned, unconventional production in Europe with some of the big European players here in the U.S., in JVs, in the Marcellus, in the Haynesville, changing the game there, and as well with North American producers active now in Europe developing the unconventional base, it will be a game changer, but in our view, probably not until the end of the next decade. So again, beyond that 2017, 2018, 2019 period.
There we go. Okay. Well, I might comment that natural gas is the manic depressive, one of the fossil fuel sources. We have been through a period of depression. We are now in the manic phase. And I think it's kind of useful to step back and realize that things are not as bad as you thought they were when it was depressive, and they may not be as good as you think they are when it's manic. So let me just give you a cup of coffee. I'm optimistic, too. But one, clearly, the water and water disposal problems are big, and the more you move into NIMBY areas, they will be a critical issue. But the second one is a kind of an interesting one, and that is, what does shale gas really cost? There is a kind of a technological debate going on among some of the petroleum geologists. The interesting thing that's happening is that the shale resources have extremely low permeabilities. The ability to drill horizontally and to fracture essentially creates a reservoir within a reservoir, and that reservoir that is contained in the overall reservoir has extremely high permeabilities. So what you get is almost puncturing a balloon. You get a very fast drawdown, and some of these shale gas things have 60% decline rates. Now, producers, as is their wont, like to book reserves, and they like, in an era in which unit of production accounting deals with the costs, to assign them to the reserve base. The reserves are being logged 50 years into the future. The real question is, do you get down to a point where it's no longer economically feasible to let those reserves bleed? And if so, you don't go back and work over the well in classic sense. You go back and drill new wells. So the question is there something about the costs we do not understand? But I'm not going to solve that for you, but that's being debated at the present time. And the other thing on here is, of course, the Arctic gas, and it's a big project. It is a big risk for whoever invests in it. It's a chance for the company to bet the store and for the CEO to bet his career. And it has consistently been that nobody's been quite willing to take the risk, and the world, if anything, has gotten more uncertain. So I'm not very optimistic about Arctic gas.
And by the way, as one with long memory here, when I was first at DOE, Jim was one of our consultants on the Alaska Natural Gas pipeline the first time around, which was about 1975, wasn't it? 75, 76, yeah. Well, with that brief introduction of the supply topic, I'd like to open up the floor now, because there's so much expertise in this audience. I know we could probably go on for the rest of the hour or so we have left just on this topic, but let me stand so I can see, so otherwise I'll miss people on this side of the room. Who'd like to start off with, I think you were the first, ma'am. And would you just state your name and affiliation, please?
I'm Jan Gilbert from the Environmental Protection Agency. Any of the pricing analyses that you have here, do they take into account the effect on natural gas prices from any kind of CO2 regulation, whether it's in the United States, the European Union, or the recent commitments that the G8 made to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in their countries?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Yes. So the projections I have do not have any of the CO2 limitations in them. So.
Our projections have European carbon framework, regulatory framework. Within the U.S., we have not, we have the influence of the anticipation of federal carbon legislation on the numbers, all right? So we have relatively aggressive coal plant retirements over the next few years. We're not building any generic coal plants within our modeling after the wave of new coal capacity additions takes place over the next few years. The reason we've kept it out of our base case is just that it's changed so much over the last year and a half, 2 years, and it has such an overwhelmingly influential impact on our gas price outlook and our demand outlooks. We've worked through carbon cases separately. We worked through a case based on Lieberman-Warner a few years ago before we had really unlocked the potential of the shale play, and it tended to increase our gas prices by as much as $4 to $5 per MMBTU, just the commodity price. Recently, we worked through Waxman-Markey. It had a less supportive effect in terms of the price, simply because of the resource base, but we ended up with some cost pressures associated with high drilling required to bring the new natural gas supplies on. So it's hugely influential, and we continue to analyze it, but within these prices, it's not part of the framework because of the uncertainty.
And let me just say one other thing, just to add to that, is that one of the things that we struggle with the modeling is that if you do have access to low-carbon technologies like a large nuclear build or a biomass to power, then you end up not using gas as much because gas is, although it's much lower emissions, it's still 40% of the carbon of coal. So I guess as Jen said, we want to keep the reference case a little bit clean. But then when you get into the details, it matters a lot how much certainty there is with the regime, what is the ability to do something like nuclear, will the large capital costs associated with some of those encourage or discourage? So it's sort of the effect on gas is very unclear. You have the sense that, of course, demand for it will increase if there's carbon limitations, but how much is really very uncertain.
Someone over here had a. Oh, look, Morton, since you're right here,
My name is Morton Frisch, and I'm actually representing the
Mike. Europe. I'm Norwegian, but I'm based in the United Kingdom, and I run a consulting firm there. I wish that the panel is right, both with respect to unconventional gas and also LNG gen when it comes to Europe as a Norwegian. But I'm not as pessimistic as you when it comes to Europe, when it comes to unconventional gas. I think that there are going to be tremendous economic pressures to develop this resource, which clearly also has a large potential in Europe, and to develop it quickly. I think that restrictions we have seen on, for example, onshore drilling in some countries will be eased. This gas also has got large potential offshore, where, you know, it's easier to get permits, you know, to drill up, you know, these prospects. Turning now to the LNG, during the first 6 months of this year, the world produced 2 million tons less LNG than they did on average in 2008, in spite of a number of new plants coming on stream. Although the industry is saying that they're not curtailing their production, in reality they do, through extended work programs, turnarounds, etc., of plants, and also of a slow completion of new plants coming on stream. Unfortunately, I do not agree with the curve, you know, you showed, you know, for import of LNG to the United States. I think that, you know, it's going to be less than what you are showing. I think that more of this product likely will end up in Europe, also in the Far East. As we discussed this morning at the gas expert meeting, I cannot see that, you know, economics will allow, you know, the price disparities, you know, you were showing in your slide. You know, please feel free to comment on what I'm saying, but I've got difficulty with what you've been presenting.
Yeah, we actually completely agree on the curtailment of LNG supplies globally. Some producers have been public about the fact that they're scaling back because of the weak market conditions. Some haven't. But one of the things that we saw this year and we struggled with rationalizing into 2010 was kind of opportunistic maintenance and maintenance programs accelerated that resulted in more downtime. The question is whether, given that we saw that kind of behavior this year, we see that behavior again next year. And it's an open question. We are asked a lot, a good bit, about our LNG expectations into the U.S. for 2010, and it's very unpredictable because one of the things we've seen over the last few months is, you know, as the global prices have firmed, and they haven't firmed that much, they've firmed $4.50 to $5 from, you know, below $4 from MMBTU. We've seen that LNG ramp up, and we've seen some of those projects come back in. So it's very hard for us to say, you know, do LNG producers scale back at $3.50? Do they scale back at $4? Do they scale back at $4.50? Our expectation is as the U.S. price firms next year to $4.75, potentially $5, not necessarily a scale back price, and you see much more of that supply in the market that you didn't see this year. So we agree with you on this year. It's just very difficult to call what happens next year.
One other, Jim, did you want to comment on?
Yeah, I'm the one who believes that LNG is going up, and it's very clear that one of the things that's happened is that there have been shutdowns. Some of that is planned, some of that is unplanned, just new plants starting up. And what we're finding, a lot of new plants don't work the way they're supposed to when they first start up. Some of that's the case. There is a bulge in the two-year capacity increases that is starting this half of the year going into next year. And so in a sense, if the unplanned stuff and the planned stuff is out of the way, you're going to still see the bulge. And I have been very much of the view that you're going to see more LNG and it's going to affect prices.
Yes, right. Yes, sir.
I'm Richard Ranger with API. I'm wondering if the panelists would want to comment on the scenario that the continuing development in the North American gas endowment, particularly the shale gas endowment, could in out years lead to the possibility of North America actually being an LNG exporter.
Okay, I'm very skeptical. First of all, last year for LNG suppliers was a boon year if you had spot cargoes available because the Japanese were in desperate trouble. Tokyo Electric had a nuclear shutdown problem, shut down 7 reactors. They were buying cargoes at anything, you know, terribly high prices. And a lot of people saw those high prices and said, wow, wouldn't it be fun to be an exporter? Those prices no longer exist. And if you've got to put in an LNG plant, you want to make sure you have enough supply to cover a big upfront investment over a long period of time. And I'm not sure that very many people see that. One of the interesting plants, of course, is Kitimat in British Columbia. And just for the fun of it, I'm doing a project and forecasting prices in India for a project there. And so I'm very interested in the Japanese market. And I ran the economics on Kitimat with my view of what is happening to prices, and wow, it's a non-starter. So,
I'll make a quick comment on that. I think North America is much more likely, kind of longer term, to export the technology and the shale techniques and the manufacturing processes we've developed along with the shale resource base than to necessarily export the product, because the differentials are extremely difficult to bridge with liquefaction. And You can look at Japanese oil index prices, parity to oil. You can look at high oil prices and make the economics work. But ultimately, there's only so much demand in Japan, and whether it holds up at those prices is a different issue. So I think it's more likely that we'll export the technology and also, as well, kind of see some revitalization of the U.S. petchem industry and more product export rather than necessarily exporting the gas.
Ben Schlesinger? I don't know whether – is that the only mic?
Yeah. On the subject of LNG exports, I gave a talk on this a couple of weeks ago at the NCAC.
And probably, I guess, got some of this started, although I can't take credit for it. It's a concern with the, for example, Marcellus Shale, which is, as Jen pointed out, more or less bottled in western Pennsylvania with the difficulty of constructing added pipeline capacity in the Northeast. Very high cost capacity increases would be needed to move it to those markets. Moreover, those aren't really great markets anyway because they're so highly seasonal. And in fact, there's a huge amount of pipeline capacity connected with the Marcellus Shale. It just doesn't happen to flow to the Northeast. In fact, it's gas pipeline capacity coming from the Gulf. And all you need to do is reverse that capacity. You've got an enormous outlet for Marcellus. But then what do you do with it? So LNG exports don't sound so crazy, you know, in that regard, especially with the persistent price gap that Jen's shown and that I think some other people are showing between the North American continent and Europe. Europe would be the destination for this LNG, not Japan. Japan market's too thin. And as Jim correctly points out, it had its real exciting day about a year ago. It's possible another nuke will go down and prices will be up. But the market's not nearly as thick as the market in Western Europe. Western Europe is extremely interested, from our experience and projects that we've done, in getting off Russian gas as much as they possibly can. These people have a take-or-pay crisis, not unlike ours, of 25 years ago. And they're poised, I think, to accept gas from other sources very, very willingly. So I guess that's why I kind of believe, you know, how much we're going to export, to me, is the only question.
Oh, sorry, Bob, the delay.
Bob Hershey, I'm a consultant. What's the current status of gas to liquid conversion like they were doing in Qatar?
I think the current status is that they are very unhappy they started doing that. And it's a little bit surprising because when you look at the divergence between oil prices and gas prices that we're showing, it just cries out for GTLs. You say, why aren't we doing more of that? And I'll let Jen and Jim, who are closer to the commercial folks, speak to this. But I think it has to do with the newness of the technology. In other words, it's still very expensive. People still think there could be a breakthrough that could make it cheaper. And then just the enormous capital commitment you're making to this, and you're making this bet on a difference between oil and gas prices, and I think that's what makes people very uncomfortable. It could be, and someone mentioned this morning, I just don't remember who, that perhaps the most logical place is to put it into a landlocked place. So if you have a large gas resource that's not close to water, then perhaps you would put in a GTL plant and it would make sense then. But it does seem in this current environment where capital is hard to come by, even though we have this persistence difference that would seem to make it very profitable, it seems unlikely to do more than the current plants we've seen.
I think one of the problems with GTL is that it is a new technology. People are a little bit afraid of the risks. And the trouble is the projects are going into a place where you can't get enough construction workers in because there's so much stuff going on and inflation has gone crazy. So a combination of very high inflation costs in the Middle East and new technology, and people are afraid of it. So,
well, I don't know, Andrew, how long has Shell been doing GTL in Malaysia?
That was the
Andrew Slaughter from Shell.
That plant was the second phase of GTL development. There was a kind of pilot before that. So the plant in Malaysia, I think it's about 10,000 barrels a day, if I remember rightly. And that's been running for a long time, you know, 10 to 15 years. And now we're talking about scaling up to much bigger plants. But I think the opportunity is there over time to build a learning curve on technology, on construction, and operating practices to drive up efficiencies and drive down costs. So over the 25 to 30-year time frame, I think there's some running room for more GTL.
And is it Pearl plant in Qatar that
The Pearl plant in Qatar is the one that's in the final phases of construction now and will start to be commissioned over the next couple of years or so.
Can you, Mikhail Korchemkin, consultant, can you compare investment costs required to deliver, say, 1 BCF day of gas from different sources like Yamal or Qatari LNG to Europe or to the United States? And where is the most expensive gas is coming from?
So when you're thinking about the cost of bringing it, investment cost, you're talking about the capital cost, right? And so in that, do you want the government take in that too, or just the real resource cost?
Like, to drill, to
right.
To,
right.
The investment to
tell
to build an import terminal in Europe.
Yes.
Compared to do the same upstream and build a pipeline to the European border. What would be the
yes.
investment there?
Right. So I'm not going to know the answer to that off the top of my head. So maybe I better think a little bit more.
I calculated that the pipeline
yes.
option was twice more expensive in terms of investment cost than Qatari gas.
The Qatari gas was twice as expensive. So,
less
yes.
expensive. Qatari is less expensive
yes.
than option Himal delivered by mm-hmm. pipeline.
Okay.
Jim Jensen was just in Geneva last week making a presentation to the WTO touching on that very general issue. Maybe, Jim, you could comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, I have computer models that will enable me to run gas pipeline economics and LNG economics, and a lot depends upon the size, the distance, the location. There is no real generalization that you can make. So when you ask me that question, I don't even know, but if you give me a case, I can run it for you. You're talking about the investment to move it downstream, and I assume you're not talking about the upstream, or are you?
Everything.
Okay, and the problem with the upstream, nobody likes to talk about this, but in fact the upstream is very blurred. Some of the gas upstream has what I call a negative opportunity cost. That's true in gutter. Which what that means is that the sale of the liquids, the byproduct credit from the liquids, is so good that you develop the field for the liquids, flare the gas if you were allowed to do it and not care. So what that says is that the opportunity cost is the avoided cost of reinjecting it to save it. And much of the LNG is based on high liquid stuff, so much of it, in effect, has negative opportunity cost. But everybody works on a netback basis. What is the market price? What is the contract price? Deduct all costs. What can you get as a net back at the wellhead? We'll decide whether we go ahead. So people don't build up the cost from the wellhead. But if you're talking about long-distance pipelines are very expensive, particularly unless they're built to very large sizes.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Our model builds LNG. If it had 20 Qataris with the liquids available, it would build 20 Qataris with the liquids available. It's developing much less competitive LNG projects to serve the global market, and typically ahead of the big fields with the pipe supplies. And then we get into a big debate about what pipeline rates we should use for these pipelines that the model wants to utilize at 10 or 15%. So the long-haul transport tariffs and the need for a high utilization rate to make them competitive makes it a real challenge relative to LNG.
Yeah, clearly, I mean, I do some slides often showing the difference over distance and scale for pipelines versus LNG. That assumes that you can use the same route. Now, if you're going from gutter to Italy, fine, very easy. If you're going from West Siberia to Germany, how do you do that with LNG? If you're going from the Caspian to Austria, how do you do that? And what we're beginning to see more and more is that you're beginning to look for sources of gas that are interior, moving to markets that are interior, and so you've got to face the pipeline problem. You haven't had to face it when you're sort of shipping stuff to marine markets in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, or coastal markets in China. If you go into the interior of China, it's another story. So, in other words, there are places where you want to use pipelines and there are places where you want to use LNG, and it's very hard to get an absolute comparison.
Here's a perfect example. In the Far Eastern Russia, they're building this $11 billion pipeline from Sakhalin to Vladivostok, but it's cheaper to bring LNG from Sakhalin to Vladivostok.
Well, I had occasion probably 10 years ago. The Asia-Pacific Energy Research Center in Tokyo did a big study of infrastructure for gas in Northeast Asia. And I had the subcontract to do the economics for China, Japan, and Korea. Now, the interesting thing at that point was that it was very scale-intensive. And you discovered that, and the politics were such that you could make the case for certain movements that they weren't going to go politically. And one of the interesting ones at that point was Kvitka down to Beijing. I ran the economics on that. Turns out that Mongolia and China don't get along very well together. So the pipeline routing now for gas is going to go around and avoid Mongolia and go into Beijing. And interestingly enough, in this thing I did in the World Trade Organization last week, one of the things I was talking about, the cost of transit avoidance, and I have the Mongolian example of going from Irkutsk direct to Shanghai or going around the other route and show how much more expensive it is to avoid Mongolia. And I've done the same thing for South Stream and Nabucco versus direct from the Caspian, and also Nord Stream versus going from West Siberia direct.
It started in 1978 when the pipeline to West Germany had to bypass East Germany. It went down to
right.
Czechoslovakia.
Right.
Thanks. Well, I think, is there one more burning question on either shale or Arctic gas? Or?
Can I ask about gas packs?
Oh, yeah, sure, David. Sorry.
We can ask. The gas packs.
It's David Nissen from Columbia University.
David Nissen, Columbia. Thank you. We, in Jan's discussion, there was an explicit evocation of collusive cartel behavior, I believe, on the gas side. And then there's, well Jan's going to get to answer that. And in many of the discussions we've had, we've seen slowdowns of producers and so forth. And I'd like the panel to talk about whether they believe this or not. Paying attention to the fact that we can have lots of individual reasons why the pace of development has slowed down. Gutter talked a lot about absorptive capacity and costs, which could be true whether they were colluding because they anticipated their withholding to impact the global price or not. My own view is that in the oil market, you have a sovereign swing producer producing out a very cheap capacity, which it, the sovereign, effectively controls. And that characterizes no LNG supply at all. It's their businesses, they're owned by projects, the facilities are expensive, shutting it out of existing capacity is very costly. So do we really believe this gas pack story, or do we just think things have slowed down for sort of microeconomic reasons?
The incentives that we see in terms of the individual producers are all individual incentives. And so even though we don't have a Saudi Arabia, and particularly with Russia, their incentive to kind of maximize the value of their portfolio is if they hold back and pace development, they can kind of keep from getting called to the table every year to renegotiate some oil index contract terms. So they have an individual profit-based incentive to slow things down. And internal to them. So we're not assuming, we don't think this requires a degree of collusive behavior or a commitment to production levels by the individual producers with the concentrated reserves. What we do see going forward is that with the potential for shale gas development within Europe, with a potentially much wider distributed reserve base, then even those individual incentives go away because they're kind of positioning within the market is much weakened. And the other thing that we see kind of going forward is that, you know, moving away from kind of traditional oil index contract terms gives them the potential for market growth that they wouldn't have otherwise. So they're both getting undercut by potential new entrants, and as well they're undercutting the potential size of their market by, you know, going for the kinds of terms that they have in the past. But, you know, what we're seeing right now is that the market is, you know, essentially looking past to some extent this period of real looseness toward that tighter period of 2013, 2014, particularly in the Pacific. So we think that it's going to take a little time for that paradigm to potentially break.
If this was about gas pack, I might mention that I'm going to talk about that in a third panel. So,
okay. Final question on the shale or Arctic related.
Thanks, Guy. Mac Moore with the Rapidan Group. Specifically on shale, I wanted to ask the panel, to what extent do you see stricter fracking regs impacting the supply outlook for the shale reserve base? Is that a game changer for the game changer? Can we tap these shale resources without these fracking liquids?
Gosh, I was looking out in the audience to see if Michael Schall was still here. He is. Michael. You want to take that question? How would changing fracking regs change the game for shale? Is that
Michael Schall is the division head in the EIA, responsible for domestic gas projections. Michael?
Well, as many are aware, water is a
major part of the technology in unlocking the gas that's in the shale. So by rights, eliminating the use of the water would eliminate that technology and that resource. That said, there is this aspect, at least within the domestic U.S. markets, that the regulation of water and water discharge and the use of water is a state-level issue, and that states have implemented those regulations to varying levels. So, for example, when you see that the drilling in Marcellus, it's concentrated in Pennsylvania because there's a regulatory environment already in place that allows that to occur. New York State, that hasn't quite completely played out yet. So I think within the domestic U.S., that issue hasn't completely worked its way out. What does become apparent, though, is it is in the interest of the industry to have that technology be adopted, and at the individual state level, there are certain royalties that are available or certain rents that are available. So one would presume that at some point the right balance between the correct balance between environmental safety and production would play out.
Thanks, Michael. Now we'll move to the second topic, which, of course, we've talked a bit about it already, but nevertheless, I'd like to ask Jen Schneider to lead off the discussion on natural gas pricing and the interaction of regional markets, which is we've heard different views already, I think a little bit different between the Wood Mac and the EIA models and some of the comments from the audience. So, Jen, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, and we've kind of anticipated this discussion already because it is the big one. And in general, we've gone from a market in which gas prices moved with a relatively close relationship with oil prices kind of early this decade, either based on contractual terms or based on demand-side competition, as was the case in the U.S., to a literal explosion in oil prices that essentially, and a difference in regional supply access that created a real widespread in prices, with essentially Pacific Basin prices in Japan up at the top of the list, toward oil parity, Europe in the middle with 75% of oil price essentially in those oil index contract terms, and now the U.S. at the bottom with the unconventional resource base that we've developed. And so the question is, over time, whether the spread, and we've collapsed in the last year with the demand retrenchment and the addition of global liquefaction capacity. But the question is how those markets will evolve going forward and whether regional pricing differentials will potentially reflect the transport cost differentials between these markets, potentially security of supply premiums in some markets versus others, resource adequacy across different markets, or, you know, whether we're looking at a completely different framework going forward. And then in addition to the regional pricing question, we've also got a question as to the long-term differential or sustainability of a differential between gas prices on one hand and oil prices on the other hand, or, you know, what could potentially bridge these differences.
I think one of the things that is changed and you need to think about is when we did have this era in the 70s of oil and gas prices being linked, we had a large power sector that was burning resid to generate electricity. So we don't have that in the U.S. anymore to speak of, and the use of resid to generate electricity has fallen off lots of places. So although Europe is tied to oil, there's not really an economic rationale for that anymore. I mean, do you see that breaking down?
There isn't a demand-side link, and one of the arguments that we've made is that long-term, until there's a real competition between the two fuels, because there isn't at this point, and that would have to come in the transport sector, then we can maintain these wide differentials. Certainly in Europe, there's a question as to whether the historic oil index contract framework can be sustained because, again, you're not looking at that kind of power competition as you had in the past. And, you know, both in Europe and in Asia, those oil index contract terms were meant to represent
on the one hand, or meant to represent or put gas in a competitive range with these oil products. And again, that's kind of off the table, but there is a degree of comfort with the oil index contract term, certainly for producers. But as well, you know, the buyers are, the big buyers are, you know, tend to be regulated utilities and tend to have some comfort level with the oil index terms as well. So
maybe not that price sensitive.
Maybe not that, maybe not as quickly as we in North America might expect. Anytime we talk about oil index terms to a, we have a big global gas group in Edinburgh, and they tend to be much more used to and comfortable with the oil index terms going forward versus in North America. When anytime we look at a spread or a long-term oil-indexed gas price that, that rises through time, we immediately want to cut it down. So will it change? It kind of depends on what the oil price is, I guess, to some extent.
I think we're in the state in a state of tremendous flux right now. There have been some interesting developments in oil linkage, because oil linkage existed both in continental Europe and in Northeast Asia. But what happened over time is that certain constraints were put into the contracts. There were something called pass-through factors in Europe, which were reduced, which essentially shifted the extent to which the buyer absorbed the rise in oil price. In Asia, it was S-curves. An S-curve was simply a change in the slope above a certain price. We've had a series of international price arbitration disputes before arbitration courts, and I'm involved in several of them, in which the producers have been saying, wait a minute, S-curves and these various triggers or protections were designed for temporary changes in oil prices, but the new norm is high oil prices, and the producers or these buyers are saying we can't live with that. One of the very interesting ones, I mean, it's been a two-year project. I've been working for Gas Natural in Spain in a contract arbitration dispute with Sonatrach in Algeria over the Maghreb pipeline. The difference between what Sonatrach wants and what Gas Natural wants is $14 billion. They've been able to afford a lot of consultants and lawyers for that. The fascinating thing about it is that what has been happening in Europe is that continental Europe has been protected from competition because, in effect, you had price weakness in the UK, and you had the pipeline going across to the continent, but the Belgians were nervous about upsetting the apple cart, and they were trying to prevent price competition from the UK influencing the northern Europe. But the influx has been there. Spain is an isolated market, very LNG-oriented, and Tokyo Electric, with its mess up last year, totally prevented weak pricing in North America from influencing Spain. Those are all off the table now. Essentially, you're being more fully exposed. And what happened in Asia, of course, is that a seller's market, the producers renegotiated all the contracts, got rid of the S-curves, oil prices have fallen, but now they are linked. They weren't during the height of the oil price increase. And the Japanese are sitting there and saying, wait a minute, you know, we lost our protection, and now if oil prices go up, what do we do? So essentially, the whole rethinking of how you do oil price linkage, I think, is in ferment, and it's not clear how it's going to go.
Thank you. I think it's time to open the pricing and regional markets question up to the audience. And I just want to make, Glenn, you showed very clearly that the transportation sectoral use was going to be very thin,
very
as far out as you
yes,
could project. Right. And I didn't hear any disagreement from Jen or Jim. Am I reading that correctly, Jen? I didn't see a sectoral breakdown in your presentation.
We actually have a much more contained long-term oil price expectation that holds it back to some extent. So,
thank you. Yes, sir. Here comes the...
Michael Wyman with Electricité de France, EDF. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how the marginal cost of production for the unconventional resources that you're projecting in North America would compare with current marginal cost of production for conventional resources, gas resources, and also maybe if it's relevant, compare it to the marginal costs of production, including capital and any throw-ins to the state that's relevant as well in other areas of the globe.
I missed the last, the third part. You said it was unconventional compared to conventional in the U.S., and then the third was?
Unconventional in the U.S. compared to unconventional
elsewhere, yes. So the conventional in the U.S. is largely depleted, the low cost. I mean, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but the low cost conventional has been produced over the last 50 or 60 years. And so we've come to higher cost conventional in the U.S. At the same time, the unconventional, which is a lot of resource, technology has allowed that cost to decline. And so there's a lot of uncertainty in what the actual cost is for the reasons that Jim explained about the production profile so unusual and how you sort of charge that capital per unit. But the sense I think people have generally that at the $4 to $6 per MCF level, you can have lots of gas in the U.S. At least that's what our models are showing at EIA, and we're sort of updating them trying to base on experience. So, and that is very attractive to the conventional that's remaining in the U.S., which may be offshore in small pockets or small deposits onshore or very deep. So that's why you saw those lines cross. I know I went by it very quickly, but the conventional is declining, the unconventional is rising in the U.S. With respect to the other parts of the world, I think I was sort of assuming that in China, they're going to figure this out and the costs will come down. But in Europe, it's going to be more expensive. So in terms of the unconventional in the U.S. versus other parts of the world, I think it's going to depend on where you are and the industry structure there and just the costs of compensating the landowner. I think, Andrew, did you have something to add to that?
I mean, the only thing I would add is that sometimes we get in trouble with throwing out costs associated with like shale gas development, because in any given play there's a core area that's going to have the best economics, and then a tier one area, tier two, tier three. Right now in the Haynesville in particular, we're trying to figure out exactly how that core is delineated and how good the economics are as you move away from the core into other areas. So we're often guilty of giving a break even price for Barnett shale or Haynesville shale, when in fact it's a huge fan of opportunities. And you know, all the way from, you know, Barnett Core at 325 up to, you know, a cow pasture far from the core that could feature economics up to, you know, high $7 per MMBTU. And then as well, you know, the service costs have come down so much with the drilling retrenchment this year. And certainly as we kind of get back to work and as demand recovers and we're going at a higher pace, those service costs are going to increase. So it's just not a static number. And we tend to simplify it to an extent that it's just not simple.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah.
Yes, that's one of the
tax credit, tax credit with $3.25.
When we give at WoodMac we tend to publish development break-even costs, so it includes all the royalties. It doesn't typically include the acreage cost. So $3.25 includes royalties. Or includes the tax regime.
Well, the point that Jen Snyder just made, we had a session just on unconventional gas here several months ago, and USGS, Anadarko, and Halliburton all had representatives, and that's exactly the point they made, is even within the same play, you get a tier, various tiers of cost, and then you get much different across plays. And I could imagine, without really knowing, and they didn't speak about China or Hungary or Poland, but I would imagine it would be even more diverse.
Yeah, it's really way too early in the stage of development of any of those plays to know what the costs are. And again, with these new plays with Marcellus, with Haynesville, you know, every new set of test well results, you know, every next handful of wells in development can change the cost profile, because You don't know initially how the initial production rates are going to work out. You don't know exactly what the decline rates are going to look like. So our numbers tend to shift month to month as we just get more information.
Oh, I take this opportunity to make a plug for one of my other former employees, the International Energy Agency. Will be releasing its World Energy Outlook 2009 on the 10th of November, which will contain a large section on natural gas, including some analyses of the different costs of major gas fields and around the world. Andrew Slaughter from Shell.
I think the point about price. Sorry, this is Andrew Slaughter from Shell again. One of the key things about pricing of natural gas around the world that we tend to forget is that consumer pricing policies in some of the major countries have a tremendous impact on the not only those markets, but gas availability for other regions and therefore regional and global prices. And I'm thinking about Russia, Indonesia, Nigeria, Iran, which have basically depress domestic prices, which depress development and take gas away from the export market. If those constraints were somehow mitigated over time, then global gas pricing would equilibrate at a much probably different level than anybody is assuming.
Yes.
Very good. Very good point, and maybe we'll talk about it in the next section that Jim's going to kick off. But one great example is the domestic pricing in Russia. You know what I mean? But,
yes. Joel Darmstadter from Resources for the Future. To what extent would a carbon tax or its equivalent in cap and trade of whatever assumed magnitude one of the panelists may want to assume change the picture that so far has pretty much abstracted from greenhouse gas implications of the respective fuels against which natural gas competes?
I don't know if Len, I know.
We answered a little bit of that earlier.
I'll just make one kind of quick point, which is that the implications on gas pricing for a cap and trade versus a tax are very different. A cap and trade basically takes a good bit of the price elasticity of demand from the power sector actually out of the equation. And one of the things we're seeing in Europe now is a lot more, our gas demand doesn't change much given competitive positioning, but the carbon price is very heavily influenced by the gas price. It's pretty interesting. It's almost like an inelastic gas demand. Whereas a tax has the impact, depending on how high it is, of flipping dispatch between gas and coal. But as potentially the gas commodity price rises with that increased demand coming from the gas-coal competition, you're essentially getting closer to or kind of revert or dampening some of that price signal. I did not say that very well. But essentially, as the gas price increases associated with more demand coming in because of the carbon tax, gas gets less competitive with coal. So it's like there's a much stickier potential gas price increase associated with a tax versus a cap and trade, which could really send gas prices up if you have an aggressive early carbon limit.
I think it's important to recognize that cap and trade is really designed to set certain physical limits on how much carbon is produced and let the market decide what the price is. Essentially, a carbon tax decides what the price is and tries to figure out how the market will respond. Fact is, we do not know the relationship between price and carbon reduction. That's an unknown, but each one approaches it from a different side, and you sort of take what you get as a result. So,
yeah, that was a much better way of saying it. But I would also say that in the near term, aggressive early carbon targets are likely to be met by displacing coal with gas. And so over time, the technology options or offset program development or other options come onto the table. But in the early years, it's really about flipping gas and coal.
Michael Shaw, did any of the work that you did on Waxman-Markey have shed any light on Professor Darmstadter's question?
Well, I wouldn't want to address that directly here because I'm not quite sure how to answer the question exactly as stated. However, one of the things that we show, say, in the most recent analysis is that, once again, natural gas is not entirely carbon-free, as Glenn has pointed out, and that some of the options that we include, such as nuclear, biomass power, coal with carbon capture sequestration, provide options that allow for meeting these targets, perhaps more competitively than reliance on natural gas alone.
Oh, Tom Woods.
Tom Woods, I'm an independent consultant. I work with RBAC. My question is more along the lines to consider this, is that maybe the linkage between oil and gas prices, which has been the traditional way of doing it, is something that's going to break down, and there'll be different linkages, say, like gas prices and carbon prices. I mean, I'll give you an example, is that in the mid-70s, when the oil price went up the first time, coal followed oil and gas up step by step until the mid to late 70s, when suddenly nuclear power became the marginal source of electricity in a lot of areas and began to cap the coal price. And so what you might begin to find is that it's not a question of what's the market, but in any individual country, you might have a contract, but that contract might either price you out of the market or price you back into the market. And I'm just wondering, have you looked at linkages, say, between gas prices and, say, carbon taxes or gas price, say, and the option for nuclear? Because in the end, it will be the alternative that will determine the linkage over the long term.
Well, I mean, I think that is the point I tried to make right at the very beginning of my first talk, was that we see gas competing against other non-mobile sources of energy. And so it really, the action really is in the power generation sector. That's where the marginal use of gas is. And so if prices are being determined at the margin, it's going to be what it's competing against in that power generation market. And to the extent that they don't have market prices or you have subsidized prices in a country, that'll distort that. But it basically will be that just that optimization of what's the most economic power, way to generate power.
I have fairly strong views about that, and that is that when we first got oil linkage in Europe and in Northeast Asia, oil was the competition, no question about that. It ceased to be the competition now almost everywhere. Last year in Tokyo it was, because Tokyo Electric was trying to generate power any way it could and was buying residual fuel oil. That's why the cargo prices were so high. Now the linkage to competitive fuels is getting very indistinct. It is possible to devise a formula that is intellectually satisfying but has no market meaning. And that's basically the problem. You know, how do you devise something? You can say, well, there's such and such a percentage of nuclear, such and such a percentage of coal. Fine, beautiful calculation, but what market meaning does that really have? And I think that's the problem everybody is facing right now, and that's why I think we're in a period of ferment, because it's going to change. I agree with you, but it's not clear where it's going.
Martin.
I just wanted to give a comment to this, because as it happened, you know, I was actually one of the architects of the pricing formula you're talking about. And what we tried to do when we started this in the mid-70s at home in Norway, when we inherited gas sales agreements and also pricing formula, which had been taken out of the U.S. market, that really didn't fit the European scene at all. And the country which was really taking the lead on this was Germany, led by the then Ruhrgas, not just, you know, on behalf of Ruhrgas, but the German also consortium consisting of Ruhrgas, BB, ThyssenGas, sometimes also Mobil Oil Aktiengesellschaft in Hamburg was part of this. Then they made, you know, this group made a European consortium, which also included Gasunie in Holland, Distrigas in Belgium, Gaz de France in France, and sometimes the Austrians and also the Italians hung on to this group. So it was, you know, they were negotiating for Europe. We took market data from the Wiesbaden statistics in Germany, how, you know, the market was divided up
between industry and households. And what we found, and we took the percentages, you know, of sort of how gas was penetrating these markets, and we set, you know, the proportions according to heavy fuel oil and also gas oil, which you call number two heating oil. The pass-through factors you're talking about is actually negotiated percentages, typically 90% for heavy fuel oil and 85%, you know, for gas oil. what they were meant to represent, since, you know, the gas was purchased on the border of the country, you know, buying the gas, and the data was actually taken from in the heart of the market, that percentage was meant to represent the transportation cost from the border into the market the gas was going to serve. Of course, you know, what has now happened, and this has been, you know, a process that's been going on for the last 30 years, is that gas has taken more and more market share, and there is hardly any, you know, liquid competition to gas in most of the stationary markets. This is the case in the United Kingdom. This is the case in Germany. That was the model where actually the German, you know, heating market was the largest, you know, number two heating oil market in the world during the heating season. No longer the case. And so what you are saying, to try then not to find a way, you know, to represent, you know, the competition in the market and how the gas is placed in the market is becoming increasingly difficult. By the way, the French always insisted on that 25% of the indexation should be nuclear power because the nuclear power was so large, you know, in France. And they said, well, therefore, we should use then for the nuclear power component, we should use the retail price, you know, for electricity. At home in Norway, said, no, we won't want to touch that because that's controlled by the French government. And we don't want you to set, you know, the price for the gas we are supplying to you. So we took the retail price instead, whereas, you know, the Russians accepted, you know, the retail price, you know, of electricity in their contracts. So, you know, that's how it has now evolved. But what now is happening in the market in Europe, where we now got a two-tiered price system in continental Europe, we have got the long-term agreements with prices, some of them as low as $6 per million BTU, others, you know, about $8 per million BTU. And then we've got the spot market in continental Europe, growing very fast indeed, and particularly in Germany. What we see is that small operators in the market that hasn't got take-or-pay agreements are now going to, you know, the hubs, buying spot gas, selling the spot gas, behind the back, if you may, of the large large, you know, utilities with the take-or-pay import agreements, eroding the customer base of these companies. And as a result of this, and also then, you know, obviously, you know, also magnified by the recession, at the end of the gas year, you know, on the 30th of September, take-or-pay commitments, you know, where companies had to pay for gas, they had failed to lift last gas year, amounted to approximately $2.5 billion. We think that this number, you know, is likely to increase substantially this coming gas year because this process, you know, is accelerating. And we think that it is going to be a large change in the way the European gas market, you know, is operating. We think that it's likely that utilities that in the past has been very keen on operating a pipeline system as well as, you know, a commercial gas model on the same pipeline system most likely will split those two functions into two separate legal entities. The reason for this, we're going back to what happened in the UK in 1976 when British Gas, when because of competition, they were buying up all the gas they could buy in the market to try to prevent competition from developing. And suddenly, late 1975, British Gas found themselves with a take-or-pay problem worth £40 billion. The company was technically bankrupt. What did they did? They took all these gas contracts, put in a separate company called Centrica, which was not meant to have any assets, and therefore this company could be allowed to go bankrupt and to be dissolved and for, you know, the long-term take-or-pay agreements to be null and void, effectively. I think we could possibly see a similar development in continental Europe where, you know, the utilities, which has been under pressure from the European Commission to split up in separate units, now will start doing this in, you know, on their own accord in order to avoid losing, you know, this infrastructure in a potential claim, bankruptcy claim, because of the large, costs now associated with maintaining take-or-pay provisions in contracts and at the same time when they're losing so much market share. Thank you.
I think we have to move to the next. You want to make one?
Do you have any
Russian
comments?
One final comment.
I want to comment on the Mikhail Kostchemkin again, on the price of gas in Russia. Actually, it is not as bad. It's already above $2 per MCF at the outlet of transmission pipeline, excluding all taxes. So in about 2 years, the price is very likely to double because the ruble is gaining against dollar and the government has set the price growth at 45%, 40 to 45% a year. So after a very short period of time, we may face a situation under which Gazprom would be unable to sell, it is already unable to sell additional gas to Europe, while Russian consumers will be forced to pay the price higher than European. So this may divert the focus of Gazprom from Europe to Russia. That's an interesting point. Thanks.
Well, that's a good lead into the last topic, which Jim Jensen is going to kick off on the key players and the exercise of market power, as we call it here. I think it's brought more broadly to maybe the geopolitics of gas, another way to put it. Jim?
The fact that market power is in the title means that I probably have to talk about GASPEC, and so I will. I've always been pretty skeptical that GASPEC had much reason to exist. They say that generals like to fight the last war. The last war was oil, and the big geopolitical skirmish was OPEC. The next war is gas, and there will be some very big geopolitical skirmishes, but I don't think GASPEC is one of them. Now, interestingly enough, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade specifies that countries cannot exercise export controls. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Indonesia, Venezuela are all members of the World Trade Organization. The reason is that the World Trade Organization doesn't worry if you regulate production. And in fact, the production, the quotas in OPEC are production quotas. They are not export quotas. Now, just stop and think about the gas market. The 13 OPEC members export 76% of their oil as and consume only 24% of it themselves. And that oil you move by tanker, it is a flexible commodity, can go anywhere in the world. If you take the top 13 export producers of natural gas, and I'm really talking about interregional, so I'm ignoring Canada to the U.S. or Norway to Germany, it turns out that only 36% of their gas is exported, which means that if you put in production controls, you're really controlling domestic markets much more than you're controlling exports. Furthermore, the exports are split roughly half between pipeline and LNG, and LNG may become much more destination flexible, somewhat like oil tankers, but pipelines are not. And much of the gas export is still governed by long-term contracts, in which if essentially one of the partners does not perform, there are financial penalties, and you can go to the international courts to get settlement. Now, try to figure out how you're going to manage something like that in Russia, which is largely a pipeline exporter, trying to decide how to control exports out of gutter, et cetera. Not easy to do. Furthermore, OPEC gets credit for an awful lot of price increases that are probably not really they should get credit for. Clearly, at times when there's a surplus of producing capacity and prices are likely to go through the floor, they've been able to be effective. Last year, when we had a shortage of producing capacity, OPEC was largely powerless. In other words, it did not work in that kind of an environment. Take a look at natural gas. In LNG, we have averaged 3 new LNG terminals, trains per year over the last 10 years. This year, we're getting 8 of them. In other words, this is an expanding business. Now, interestingly enough, I maintain a database in which I put all the LNG plants in, and I have 2 categories. One is probable, one is possible. And they're all stuff in the trade press. Now, the yield from that group of probables and passables is going to be fairly low. I mean, not all of them will be built. The interesting thing is that the total amount of capacity in that database at the moment is double the capacity that was in place at the end of 2008. And in fact, if you take a look at Australia and you look at Iran, they represent nearly half of the capacity sitting out there. They're not, I mean, Iran is an OPEC member, but it's not an exporter at the moment. And Australia, are you going to get them to join GASPEC? I don't know. So essentially, I think it is such a complex thing, and I'm not convinced that OPEC is up to it. That's my view of GASPEC. Now, the other question is, who are some of the key players? I would put four out on the table for interest. One would be Russia. And, of course, in Russia, one of the questions is, Russia, is Gazprom a commercial venture, or is it a vehicle for geopolitical expansion on the part of the Russians? And adding to that, of course, is the great dispute with Ukraine, which is really shaping a lot of what goes on. The Russians have essentially managed to irritate its largest customer. And so essentially the European Union is desperate for diversification. That's obviously stimulated an awful lot of LNG because it's a way of getting out from under Russian pipelining. The Russians have said, okay, you guys are going to diversify, let's diversify. So you get the Russians very interested in the UK market, and when it looked like North America was going to be a big LNG importer, wow, let's go. You know, let's go for the US. And obviously that debate still hangs forward. And, of course, if the U.S. drops out, it takes one of the diversification options away from Gazprom. So that's the Russian issue. The second one I would put on is Iran. You know, essentially, if you look at the world's gas reserves, Iran is the second largest holder of gas reserves. And in the thing we saw this morning, the interesting thing is in the forecast going forward that EIA has, they assume that the growth in domestic consumption within Iran and reinjection in the oil fields is going to gobble up most of the stuff, and, you know, they're not going to be exports. I would argue that for a lot of reasons, I would not expect both of those trends to continue out in time. I think they're current for the present time, but I think the potential for a lot of more exports will occur. But obviously, Iran, under sanctions, all of the problems that exist, is very problematic. The third area I'd put in is the Caspian. We are now having a battle over who controls the gas in the Caspian. And the interesting thing is that we had a battle over Caspian oil. And it looks like the West beat the Russians out because essentially the big oil and the big gas in the Caspian is on the eastern shore. And the big oil, largely in Kazakhstan, could be barged across to Baku, to Azerbaijan, and the BTC pipeline could bring the oil down to the Mediterranean and get it outside of Russian control. You cannot barge gas across the Caspian from Turkmenistan. You've got to put in a pipeline. The Caspian is a lake, and therefore the law of the sea does not apply. People are not quite sure how you solve the right-of-way across the Caspian, so the Trans-Caspian line is hung up. The Russians and the Iranians will argue that the literal estates have to agree. And if you're trying to build a pipeline that avoids Iran and Russia, you've got a problem. And interestingly enough, the battle is taking place now largely between China and the Russians because both of them, and Turkmenistan has the big gas, although they seem to have done something fraudulent, and it may not be as big as people think. But at any rate, the interesting thing is that the Chinese want to tap Turkmenistan gas, and the Russians want to control it for Europe. I did a sort of a back-of-the-envelope calculation. I figure the Chinese have to spend $2 more to move the stuff to Shanghai, the Turkmenistan gas, than you would have to spend if you were going to take it to Baumgarten in Austria. But the interesting thing is that you have Nabucco, which is a free-market, Western-organized operation requiring funding from commercial sources, competing with the Russian versions, South Stream, for example, or the Chinese pipeline. You have two command and control pipelines in which you don't have to go to Wall Street to get money, competing with Nabucco, which is a classic Western project that doesn't have enough gas to satisfy any banker. So in a sense, the interesting question is, how does that all work out? That's the third one. And the fourth one is China. The interesting thing about China is that the Chinese keep saying how much gas they're going to be importing. The IEA and the EIA to date have been skeptical, and I'd have to say I'm skeptical too, because on purely economic grounds, the Chinese have had relatively cheap coal and they have very expensive gas. And if you let economics drive it, then essentially it's not going to happen. But if you say that the Chinese are so interested in trying to solve their pollution problems, that economics be damned, and they've shown us tendency to behave that way, then all of a sudden you really get a big burst in demand from China. So those are the four key players that influence things that we do not really understand. So,
and do you want to make any comments on it?
I think there are a lot of things going forward that look relatively uncertain. And, you know, just three things in particular that I don't want to lose track of. One is just the pace of recovery out of the global recession and just how big the demand influence could be if we really are kind of back on track and headed toward quick growth, or if, you know, we see potentially another down dip or another set of asset bubbles in the next few years. Two, the potential, well, federal carbon legislation within the U.S. and what form it takes, and associated demand decisions here or potentially much higher demand ramps within the next few years, very uncertain. Three, the oil price itself, because all of the kind of discussion around oil indexation and whether those terms break or whether they loosen over time, almost regardless of whether there is a direct competition now between oil and gas for market share, all that change kind of depends on just what that oil price looks like long term. And we can talk about the demand side competition between gas and oil, but oil prices have been a pretty strong indicator of gas costs. So we've got a cost connection at least between the two. And then the third thing is the fourth factor is just the pace of shale gas development, because it really is not only an unknown here as we develop these new reserves, and again, as the assessment of these reserves changed almost month to month, but you know how quickly that technology gets exported. So I would not like to discount the uncertainty associated with numerous factors on the table, in addition to just understanding the strategic implications of some of these key players and big global questions.
Just two quick things, because I know we're getting late. One, this is why I always enjoy doing things with Jim, because I always learn something, and learning about the export controls, that's fascinating. I need to reconcile that somehow with Gazprom's strategy of having a stranglehold on export capacity out of Russia. I think they're not thinking that there's something about their ability to control the ownership of that pipeline that is they can constrict exports, I guess is what I'm saying. But I'll talk to you later about that. The reason I was always pessimistic about the ability to exercise market power in the gas market has to do with it's difficult to exercise market power if you're facing an elastic demand for your service. And because gas is competing against non-mobile energy sources, the demand is more elastic. And then the shale gas with the elasticity of that supply just exacerbates the problem. So the elasticity for exports that those producers are facing seems like it's getting more elastic all the time, and that to me was the reason that I was pessimistic about their ability to exercise market power.
Thank you, Glenn. Maybe we could take a few questions or comments and as a group, and then ask the panel to react to them. It might be able to help with the limited amount of time we have left. Lou Pugliarese?
Yeah, I just have a quick question, and maybe Jim or Glenn. If gas discounts from its historic relationship with oil long term, it must be possible to turn it into a liquid. And you know, we know that GTL technology exists. Does anyone have an idea of the cost? I mean, at what point, it's like putting a coker in a refinery, at what point does it become very interesting to start turning gas into distillate? And does that kind of tell us what the backstop price is for oil?
Any other question or comment or two before we ask the panel? Yes.
Yeah, another quick one would be just at least the this leave and out of Ventex. Short term, you know, look like a lot of price pressure, price discounting globally. I know it's not a good predictor of prices, but it seems like the forward curves, NBP or Henry Hub, have been looking for a pretty strong rebound. Just a quick comment maybe on what the forward curve is doing.
Before I turn it over to the panel to answer, if not, maybe I think we had already had a discussion a little bit on GTL, but maybe Lou, wasn't here for that.
Just quickly, in the modeling, we love to build GTL, and so it's clearly economic, and so the question is, why isn't more of it happening now? Well, I'm not going to know that. We in the model have $22 per million BTU for oil and only $11 per million BTU for gas, and it wants to build a ton of it. So, but I'm sorry, I don't know that other number off the hand. The top of my hand. And then with respect to the forward curve, it's just the short-term energy group continually forecasts gas prices in the short-term energy outlook, and they've always been going below the forward curve, and they've been more correct. So I'm not quite sure why the forward curve is high, but it does not seem right now to be a good predictor of the price that we actually realize.
Yeah, I'll comment on that. I mean, the issue with GTLs is just the uncertain costs and the risks associated with such big capital programs and projects. But in terms of the forward curve, it's hard for us to rationalize the price levels right now simply with the resource base we've established, with the amount of LNG coming into the market. It might not, you know, we might hold back LNG production at a gas price $4, $4.50, but the forward curve is probably pretty supportive of good utilization on global liquefaction capacity. So it looks to us as well as if the cash price is likely to come in under the forward curve, you know, even looking at the risk of a colder winter, even looking at the risk of, you know, potentially even a faster supply decline than we expect or quicker economic recovery.
Anything to add, Jim? Or?
Well, I mean, my impression is that I have a better feeling for Henry Hub. I think there's a tendency to ignore LNG and focus very much on decline curves and drilling rigs and all that. And I, as I've said, I'm a believer that the LNG surge is ahead of us this next year. And so, in a sense, if you ignore the international, you've made a mistake on the high side. I don't have as good a feeling for the NBP, but clearly people in the UK are very impressed with the decline in the North Sea, without any question. But we're starting up the big new LNG terminals in the UK, and there's a lot of stuff that's headed to the UK, and I'm not sure that the same ignorance of the effect of the international LNG market may not be operating there. So,
any final comment, question? That time is basically up, but one comment I wanted to make is that all of the presentations today, and Jim, were you going to make no? Any other, but Glenn's and Jen Snyder's PowerPoints will be on the CSIS Energy website probably tomorrow, huh, Lisa? Well, soon. And so please join me in thanking three excellent presenters tonight. And thank you all for your kind attention and